I was going to the worst place in the world, and I didn't even know it yet. Weeks away and hundreds of miles, up a river that snaked through IT security like a main circuit cable plugged straight into Chris Hadnagy. There's no way to tell his story without telling my own. And if his story really is a confession, then so is mine. The machinist, the one they called Taylor Banks, was from Atlanta. He was wrapped too tight for information security, probably wrapped too tight for Atlanta. Ron Reck on the Forward 50 was a famous linguist from the Northern Virginia suburbs. Ethan, Mr. Clean, was from some South New Hampshire shithole, and the Light of Space podcasting really put the zap on his head. One look at him and you wouldn't believe he ever cracked a password. Then there was Pharaoh, the chief. Might have been my mission, but it sure as shit was the chief's boat. Join me, Mrs. Y, as healthy paranoia descends into the heart of darkness with expert and author Chris Hadnagy to discuss social engineering. So this is exciting. So we have, we're going to do my first show on social engineering. And that's actually one of my favorite topics because I love, you know, psychology, neuroscience, emotional intelligence. And Chris is the man. This is great. I'm so excited to have you on the show, Chris.
Thank you. I am a man, not sure about the man.
Well, you teach, tell everyone about yourself. I mean, you've written a book. Talk about your book.
The book was it's kind of a funny short story. This was not part of my 5-year plan. I'm not an author. I did not plan on writing a book. I was actually approached by a publishing house that was interested in having me write a book based on the framework that we had put up on the social-engineer.org website. And I kind of turned them down. You know, I said, I'm really not interested. I'm not an author. And then they kept coming back and talking. They basically talked me into it after a bit. We put the application in, and the president of that publishing house turned it down. And he said, I don't think it's going to sell. It's not a very good idea. So I was like, yeah, you see, I told you. You know, not a really good plan. And that person ended up sending the application into my present publisher, who happened to be Kevin Mitnick's old publisher. and they called me and they were like, hey, we want this. We'll take the book. You know, you just start writing. And I was like, I'm really not an author. I don't think I can do it. So at the time I was working with Offsec and I was working with Maddie, and he said, no, man, you should really do it. So after much consideration and almost being forced, I signed up, started doing it. I got my first chapter back, and I don't know if any of you guys ever worked with professional editors, but the way that it works is with Wiley, you have 3 editors. So I had like an English editor, like just a grammar kind of layout editor, and then a technical editor. And each one had a different color, red, blue, and green. And they put it's right into the document, and you get it back, and it shows. I swear there wasn't one thing that was the original black. It was all red, blue, or green.
Well, I think it's a fine book. I think it's a great 101 guide for all of you budding social engineers out there. Between that and I'd like to point out that Chris has a great podcast.
Thank you.
Available on iTunes. You've talked to some really cool people like Ekman, who I'm a huge fan of. You also teach classes at Black Hat, and I think wasn't it Black Hat and some of the other big security cons out there?
I have a 5-day class I wrote on social engineering, and I started it outside Black Hat, and then for the first time ever, I guess we submitted the app to Black Hat, and they let us in. They let us do the course this past year.
And that must be like 5 days of pure joy.
I love it. My partner in the class is Robert Dreek. He's the director of the behavioral analysis program for the FBI. And the classes, and this is going to be like so braggy. So I don't mean it this way, but I can say this because I'm not 100% like Robin helped me write it. The class is so epic that he's taken some of this stuff back and actually uses it to now train his recruits in the FBI.
Oh, that's great.
So basically we tell people when they're coming to the class, you know, they're getting the same training that the government gets on how to source people, how to basically make anyone like you, how to use psychological tactics to get information from people and things. It's a 5-day psych course, basically.
And then you also, you do the social engineering capture the flag at DEF CON, is it?
Yes,
at DEF CON. And that, I've got to get on that team when you do. When you do it at hopefully the next DEF CON, maybe I can weasel my way in somehow. But
man, you want to make a call? You mean?
I want to play.
Awesome.
Yeah.
The problem we had up until last year, the first 2 years we did it, we just had a really hard time getting women to join.
Women are the best. What do they say? I've read that. They quoted some CIA guy who said that women were always the best at his best agents.
We you know, just listening to some of the calls and the way that they went, it just proves that guys, especially when we're dealing with a female, we're pretty stupid. You know, we just give up everything pretty quick. I'm not saying that every guy is that way, but you know.
If you've ever met Michelle, you'll know why, and that's because she's really, really tall and scary looking.
Oh, come on!
I swear, when I met you, I thought you were going to hit me.
All the time. Well, that's because you're a little koala, Greg. See, everybody thinks that you're a big grump. In reality, Greg is this warm little fuzzy koala.
little drunk. A kind of a drunk koala. And you know, koalas are drunk most of the time, don't you? Because they eat the eucalyptus leaves, and then as part of breaking that down into raw food, they actually basically have to alcoholize it. And so actually the reason that koalas sleep all day is because they're actually drunk on eucalyptus leaves.
That explains Australia really well now.
But I mean, you told me you do yoga. I mean, that's pretty scary.
Yoga. Scary compared to drunk koalas. I'm just curious.
Well, you know, it's lucky we have we have a linguist on, and now you might be able to get him to help you with your next book, Chris.
He's going to actually edit it or tell me how bad I am at English?
I don't know. Ron's always correcting my grammar, so he loves two things. Ron loves to torture me with misusing words. You know, or using double-edged insults to see if I can catch them, or he will then criticize me if I misuse a word somehow. That's his those are some of his favorite things.
Joy's having a friend that's a linguist.
No, she's not half as bad as you think she is.
Well, so let's roll right in. So now we've talked about all the great things that Chris has done, and everybody, and everything will be in the show notes, so that you will have. I'm sure you'll have some great groupies after the show, Chris, and Ron will probably have a few too. Some of the more, you know, superior and obscure people will be into his stuff. He's written some. I'm going to put Ron's stuff in the show notes as well because he's done some great papers. He likes to do. Ron, why don't you talk a little bit about what you do for everyone?
What I do? Mostly semantic interaction between data sets, so taking and normalizing semantics for, I guess, what's called mashups now. So.
And he sent this great Eric Clapton piece of work. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. So somebody wanted to model terrorist cells, and we were unable to get the data out of the places where they model terrorist cells. So I drew the analogy between terrorist cells and rock bands, and I downloaded a version of Wikipedia and a competing data set. And what I did was I tried to establish what the impact of Eric Clapton was on rock and roll music by generating an Eric Clapton number for everyone in rock and roll. So looking at who played with whom, or who covered whose song, or what the median life expectancy is once you start a rock and roll band, or a number of things. Yeah, if you Google Eric Clapton and RDF, which is the metadata model I use, you'll get the paper. It's about 70 pages.
Wow. That must have taken some serious time.
Well, I certainly can't claim all credit for it. My co-author, Ken Saul, who I've written a number of papers with, actually started this effort, believe it or not, in 1972 using album covers to try to figure out what the degrees of separation were from a number of people in rock and roll. And actually the cover page of the paper shows him a drawing he made in 1972 relating a bunch of rock and roll stars together.
I think what's great about Ron's work is, as we get into the discussion, I think people don't realize how powerful data analysis is now, and the kind of stuff, for example, that Ron does is the result of data and information gathered by people like Chris, or even people like Taylor. I know, Taylor, you've done a little bit of you use social engineering in some of your pen testing, right? Everybody does.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I had a very early fascination with phone phreaking that landed me many, many free pizzas and an occasional concert ticket in my my early days as a budding hacker.
Aw, isn't that cute?
Now I just consider myself kind of like a social engineer's drug dealer, right? I've got, with Ace Hackware, I've got all the supplies that you need for your social engineering engagements.
Great. Well, so let's talk a little bit about, I was intrigued by, when I read your book, Chris, how you define social engineering. And I think that's a good topic of discussion, because a lot of the people listening to the podcast they're not all security people. So maybe we should talk about what that actually means.
Sure. So I have a very broad definition for social engineering. Any act that influences a person to take an action that may or may not be in their best interest. It's a little different, I think, than what's out there, because I think that we use SE each and every day. I think we use it in non-malicious ways. I think we use the principles of influence and persuasion and manipulation just in our daily lives, which encompass what social engineering is. So we see these same skill sets when it comes to our children, our therapists, our priests, our parents, our mates, our friends. All these different types of relationships involve that.
Dude, you're scaring me. Everybody's a mark to you.
Well, I've been reading Christopher Hadnagy's book, and at the same time I've been reading Bruce Schneier's book on the Web of Trust, his latest book. And the two actually interweave with similar themes, but come at them from disparate angles. And I sometimes find myself having these thoughts and then going, I wonder if that was Chris or Bruce Schneier. Because you're both talking about their trust, you know, the relationships between people and how to hack them and break them in those two textbooks. And it's disturbing.
Well, it's funny because Chris and I met actually – well, we started emailing each other almost a year ago, I think, right, Chris?
Yeah,
because I do a lot of my work, my research work is on neuroscience and emotional intelligence, applied neuroscience, and where Chris and I differ is we're talking about the same thing, but he calls it social engineering. I call it emotional intelligence, based on Dan Goleman's book, and he looks at it for the broad range of, you know, positive as well as negative things that you can use it for. I'm more focused on the positive things that you can use it for. Although a conversation I have with Ron, he knows that I also know how to use it for negative purposes as well. and I'm not going to pretend. I mean, you know, women do it all the time, right? But I think it's interesting. I also, Chris and I also had a conversation around interrogation techniques. Because I had read a book on how to break a terrorist, and the new trends in interrogation now are much more about centered around persuasion and creating affinity, very much like social engineering.
I think it works about 1,000 times better than them strapping someone down and threatening to cut limbs off.
Well, as you have probably, as many people, I mean, Kevin Mitnick's a good example. I mean, there are hundreds more. probably thousands more that we don't even know about, but just computer hacking is probably the best example of how well creating affinity and influence is much more successful.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, when if you manipulate someone, which is very negative, you may get information out of them, but that's not really sure how well you can trust that information because you manipulated it out of them. You coerced, you forced them to give you something. Whereas with influence or persuasion, the more positive aspects of that, you're getting someone to tell you something because they want to. I mean, I love this definition of influence. Influence is getting someone to want to do what you want them to do. And it's such a powerful definition if you really think about that, because that means I'm not forcing you to do it. I'm helping you see why taking this action is the best course of action, and then you eventually want to take that action.
I mean, how much are you appealing to emotions? I mean, from what I've read, you know, the emotional side of a person, the limbic system is much faster in response than the rational part of the brain. And that's where, I mean, marketers certainly have been very successful at manipulating our emotions and getting us to do things. Do you typically focus on emotions first?
It's a multi-staged, for the lack of better words, attack, in the sense that you have to start with emotions, because the emotional connection is what builds rapport, it's what builds friendship, it's what allows you and I to connect as human beings, and you make instantaneous judgments based on emotion. So you'll base it on the way you feel about how either I sound, look, the way I make you feel, all that will make a judgment. And if I can do good by you, then I can build that rapport relatively quickly. But if I leave it at that, then it's almost like buyer's remorse. You know, if I leave it at just the emotional, you may give me some information at one point, you may comply with my wishes, but later on you're going to feel pretty bad about it because it was based only on the emotional aspect of it. So you have to quickly move from that emotional rapport building and now move it into things that make people feel good. And the one thing that makes everyone feel good is talking about themselves. So once you build rapport and you make it about that person, you can usually get people to do most anything.
Really? So Mitnick, I was looking over his book from 2002, The Art of Deception, where he just has case after case of the way he's, you know, instances where he's manipulated somebody or influenced somebody. He says at the beginning of the book that he can usually get information just by asking for it. Do you find that to be true?
I do. As a matter of fact, one of our we actually talk about this in our course, the 5-day course I talked about. And then we have a group of students. I'll give you an example. With Black Hat, we had 28 people in the class. And we have a day, first day, let's say, of our course. And then at the end of the day, we give everyone homework. And the homework is from non-service people. So they can't go to bartenders. They can't go to salespeople. From everyday strangers you meet within in the vicinity, you have to obtain certain pieces of information from them. And they have to be willing to give you this information. It has to be in a non-threatening way. So you have to basically talk people into giving you things like their name, their birthday, where they live, what they do for work. And people automatically, their attitude is, wait, this is impossible. You can't do this. People aren't going to give me that information. So we give them some tips. We give them some tricks. We tell them how to go about doing that. The next day, people come back and they have a sheet, you know, 4, 5, 10 different names of people that they gave them all this information.
Okay, well, give us a couple of those tips. Can you give us a freebie here?
No, just kidding. You know, we so it's going to sound overly simplistic, but this really is the way that it works. You have to build rapport with people. So I refer often to Robin Dreeke's book, It's Not All About Me, the 10 Steps to Building Rapport. It's an excellent book because it's like a little tiny workbook. And he talks about different aspects of how to build quick rapport with people. So I'll give you like two. Artificial time constraint is a big one. The problem or the challenge that we have when we approach people often is our nonverbals indicate I don't want to say the word scary because it's not scary. We make people nervous. I'll give you an example. If I come up to you and I have a question for you, in my mind I'm thinking, I really need to go quick, so I'm just going to get this information from you and leave. But I come at you full force, frontal. I'm approaching you with both my feet and hips pointed towards you. Your brain response is not thinking about my request, but how long is this going to take? Why is this guy approaching me this way? What does he want? And you have all of these unspoken mental questions that I have not given you an answer to. All I've done is told you what I want. And now you have to make a snap judgment. Do I trust you? Do I like the way you look? Do you sound safe? And will I answer? And all of this thinking that's happening in the background means that I'm not building rapport with you. So an easier approach with an artificial time constraint is, and using your body language, is a sidestep approach. So instead of approaching someone full frontal, hips pointing towards them, you approach someone from the side. You can have an artificial time constraint. You know, I'm just here in the store. My wife sent me to get a birthday present for my niece. I'm terrible at this, but I'm supposed to be at this party in 30 minutes. I see you have a little girl here. Is there any way you could just help me out? Okay, now what you did is you did not approach them with both your hips pointing towards them. You approached them from the side. You told them up front what you're asking for, so now they're not guessing. And you indicated that you needed to be somewhere in 30 minutes, so their brain automatically says, this guy's going to be out of my life pretty quick. That alone puts the mental block down. The wall goes away. Now the next step – I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
The next step then is to then fill in the questions with requests. So what we did at first is we made it about me. I need help. Can you help me? Now we have to quickly change that, because if it becomes all about me, the person's going to quickly lose interest and they're going to walk away. So we have to make it about them. So you could do things. I'm using this scenario in my head that we used in class. There's a woman in the store, and I'm telling you, like, you're approaching her. She's the target. You're supposed to get her name, her date of birth, and any information about her that you can. And you approach with that first initial line, can you help me get a birthday present for my niece? You say, I'm really terrible at this, but my niece just looks right about the age of your daughter here. What is she, like 3 or 4? Okay, now if she looks 5 or 6, what you just did, or 7 or 8 or even older, is you have an intentional misstatement. So that intentional misstatement, psychologically, and there's studies done on this, people have to correct you when you say something wrong. They have to. If you say something known to be wrong, then they have that. We just have this innate human need to make sure that we correct the wrong statement. So people will automatically do that. So let's say you say something like that. What is she, 3 or 4? No, she's 7 or 8. Oh, what, a June baby? And it doesn't matter. I mean, you will be surprised if you try this. It doesn't matter how off and how weird you think that's going to sound. The person will actually respond at that point. No, she was born in February 2nd.
And you're using all this to create rapport, to sort of break down the barrier, the resistance on the other side. Do you use things like I've read studies that if touch is involved, which you have to be very careful with that, but I've read some studies where if a stranger approaching women on the street, this was done in Paris. If the man touched the woman's hand or touched her shoulder, he was more likely to get a positive response to his request for a date. I mean, so do you utilize that at all, or are you nervous about using that?
I'm not nervous about using that. There's a book that talks about the power of non-sexual touch. It's all about the power of skin, and mm-hmm. skin being the largest organ that we have, and with all these sensors and nerves and feelings in it, it can do so much. It can repel you from another person, or can attract. So I think you're right in your statement that with touch, it has to be done at the right time and with the right intensity.
And then, go ahead.
You're my target, and I haven't yet built rapport with you. When I touch too early, you can be thinking, what does this guy want? And if you're not attracted to me at all, I have now just turned off any chance of moving you as a target to an actual source.
And then are you really conscious and careful about the tone of your voice and the language that you use? I mean, Ron and I have these discussions a lot, and I've read a lot of studies on how you prime people with – for example, transitive versus intransitive verbs can have a great power on how people perceive a scenario. I mean, is that something that you found to be true?
Yeah, I think for someone like me, I can say vocal tone is very important. I'm a big guy, and I'm a loud guy. So if I approach, let's say my target base is in an office, and there's a tiny little woman behind the counter as a secretary, and I come in with this big booming persona and voice, not knowing her, it can be a very big turnoff. You know, that type of authority figure may not be something that opens her up to building rapport. So I am more conscious about the nonverbal portions, not so much the words, mm-hmm. but the tone of the words, the speed, the pitch, the pace, and then, of course, the nonverbal body gestures. You know, if I'm a very strong personality too, so, you know, chest out, chin up, that mm-hmm. doesn't build confidence. It does not build rapport in a lot of people. They view it as overconfidence. So I have to, for me, someone like me, I have to physically think about these things before I go into an engagement, to lower the chin, bring the chest down, and lower my voice and my pace and pitch.
Do you take it further than that and actually sort of like roll your shoulders down and cave in, like produce a smaller version of yourself by tucking your arms in as well?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm careful to not roll my shoulders in because it's unnatural for me. So what will happen is that I'll either look uncomfortable, or what I'll do is as soon as I get like comfort in the engagement, I'll go right back to the chest up, and then people see it was kind of like a play. So what I do is my normal stance, let's say, is my chest is out and my chin is up, and it's not necessarily I'm a big proponent of the disc communication. I'm not sure if anyone here is familiar with that. If not, then I won't use the technology from there. But I'm a very dominant type personality. So my physical thoughts are to just not have my chest puffed out and to lower my chin. And that also is a physiological thing. When your chin is up, your vocal cords are a little tighter and they're louder. And you have more volume to your voice because it's like raising a horn. You know, you ever see guys in the olden days with their trumpets or horns?
Yeah. When your head is up and your chest is expanded, you throw further with your voice. It's a singing. That's a standard singing practice. The thing that I often find I use in a corporate environment is I will lean forward on a chair and roll my arms over onto my legs. And then lean down, and that makes me smaller than the person on the other side. So I'm a smaller target. I'm not a target. I'm in a subdominant position. My arms are crossed across myself while I'm looking up at them. And I find that in meetings with project managers is that they think that they're in control of the situation. And I use that just before I slap them down.
Yeah,
it's very cool to see this demonstrated as well, Chris. I think you did a very good job at DerbyCon, and all due respect to the other presenters there, I think I learned more in your hour at DerbyCon than in all of the other presentations I watched, largely because seeing you demonstrate this, it's amazing. You know, for those of you that haven't met Chris in person, again, he's not a small guy, but seeing the difference that you can perceive in the way he appears, you know, when standing with his chest out, his head up, and versus his chin down and kind of tucked, it's a rather dramatic difference in you know what somebody would assume about him coming to them or at them.
Taylor, here's a good question for you. I mean, I've seen pictures of you, and you even brought it up before. I mean, you kind of have that typical alternative hacker look with the tattoos and the piercings and stuff like that. How do you when you do the social engineering in person, do you take it down a notch? I mean, do you intentionally try to look more like one of the straight people? You know, suits.
It depends quite a bit on the nature of the engagement. So for a while, I spent some time in basically a sales engineering role, and one of the things that I had to do, I went into a lot of places, into a lot of either military bases and or organizations where the people that I was going to be meeting with were, you know, largely mid to late 50s and 60s, what I would call the gray hairs, but you know, very conservative. And so, social engineering somebody like that for me is basically, you know, dressing impeccably, remaining, you know, as clean cut as I can. Now, that doesn't mean I change my appearance. I still leave my labret piercing and my earrings in. But, you know, but the social engineering in an environment like that is demonstrating that, you know, I can still clean up and maintain a professional appearance. At the same time, in other circumstances, I might go the opposite route. So I might really play up, you know, the piercings or the alternative nature in order to kind of put somebody off guard. So I think it depends a lot on the circumstances. But, you know, it's interesting because I find that I can do it both ways, you know. I can kind of downplay the alternative nature of my appearance, and or I can upplay it and get different results, obviously, depending on what I'm trying to achieve.
Yeah, I do the same with my height. I have a group of body positions I use. I call them tall people tricks, where I can sort of shrink my height a little bit because I know that it's going to intimidate people, and my voice, I'll have to bring it down. You sort of have to, I think the point is that you're going to gauge your environment and the people that you're around and then play to that.
Exactly.
Is that fair?
Absolutely.
I use something similar when I'm working with in corporate environments. So with security people, I'm always strong and technically, like, my head is up when I'm dealing with security people because they've usually beaten down in a corporate environment. All the people who come to them, they come sort of, you know, waiting for the security person to say no. You know this story, Michelle, don't you? Security people in corporate environments, it's always no. Or, no, that's not possible, that's too hard, that's too complicated. So I always go to security people with my chest out and ready to fight for anything. And that always puts them on. That always upsets them.
Throw schmoo balls at you, so it's always good to have your head up and be paying attention anyway.
Hey, Ethan, yeah. We're finding all of Greg's dirty little secrets here. This is great.
I find working with managers, what I like doing is I like turning on them. So I like what I have this motto, and I think, you know, you were saying earlier about social engineering, you want to be, you know, get somebody to do something that they probably don't want to do. And I've always equated project management with the art of telling someone to frack off in such a way as they look forward to the trip, was the summary I once heard. And that, in a nutshell, is the summary of being an architect. So I design networks for companies, and my job is to tell project managers to frack off in such a way as they look forward to the trip. So with project managers, I'll tend to take a subdominant position, but with security people, I'll tend to go in chest out and combatively attack them because they're not used to being attacked. They're usually used to being, you know, to saying no to everybody, and they like being in charge of the situation.
Well, how do you? What do you do with language? I mean, I've seen a lot of things on how different types of in NLP, for example, they'll talk about it. You gauge whether or not somebody is a what sense they generally use in their language. If they're more sight based or if they're more sound based, do you try to gauge that as well, Chris?
Well. Yes and no. The challenge with that, what you just brought up, is that there's no scientific evidence behind that being true or not.
Right.
And all of us have a little bit of each. It is true that we're dominant of one. So we're dominant, you know, either we're all visual or kinesthetic or auditory, and one of those dominates the way that we communicate and think. That being said, doesn't mean that so I do listen for keywords. I don't necessarily try to influence that or manipulate that at all. I listen for keywords. If someone says, oh, I like the way that sounds, or I can really see what you're saying, you know, then I know they're probably a more visual or auditory person, you know, or you know, it doesn't feel too good, something like that. We know that they may be more of a kinesthetic or a feeler, and then I will try to change my speech to be more along the line of what that person will like to hear. But only if I pick that up. I don't actively try to go for it. I will try to listen for it, and then if I do, make some changes.
Interesting. So we've talked about some of the techniques that you'll use and how you sort of gauge your targets. So let's talk about some of the basics that people should be aware of. So there's the techniques that I've seen, and I put a list in the show notes. There's pretexting, where you create some fake scenario. Is that sounds like that's a technique that you use a lot?
Yeah, pretexting. I kind of go a little deeper with it. I say that pretexting is not just a fake scenario. It's even more than acting. It's you become a different person for that time period.
So do you use method, or is that like method social engineering?
Yeah,
do you have to really believe it in a way.
You do. There's a great video, Uta Hagen's. I think.
yeah.
And she talks about method acting and getting into the role, and it's a really important part of pretexting, because at times the nonverbal part of our communication will indicate if what we're saying is true or not. And now people may not be looking for that, but it's this built-in radar system that we have that makes us feel safe or not safe based on the messages that people are putting out. So if I'm coming in and I'm trying to say that low-end, low-paid tech guy, but my chin is up and my chest is out, and I'm coming in very authoritative and demanding, it's very possible that my body language will indicate that, you know, this guy is not really saying something to be true, or he's an arrogant jerk. And either way, I may not be able to succeed in my tasks at hand because of one of those feelings that I'm pushing on them. So I pretend to be fully believable, and you need to believe it. But yet at the same time, it needs to be overly simplistic. I've at times in my past, myself, and also working with other social engineers, seen people go too deep with the pretext. And the problem is, if you focus on what I said before, that it's all about them, nobody really cares about the detail of your story. But to understand a little bit of it, but trying to remember like names of dogs and kids and making sure everything on earth is played out right. It's just too many details that you'll have to try to remember. You'll slip up.
Well, I think pretexting is, for a lot of people, is going to be the most fun. That's the part, you know, the actually interacting with somebody, and you hear these great stories about getting people to give you passwords, pretending to be somebody who's on vacation. But that's just to lead you to the other parts of the hijack, which is, you know, you may then use that to, it's just the beginning of the intrusion, right? You also have diversion techniques, or you have techniques where you're not even actually interacting with the person, like phishing and spear phishing, which are considered part of social engineering. For example, in Dave Kennedy's Social Engineering Toolkit, which is, it's part of, Backtrack, which you just it just helps you set up those types of sites, right?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, phishing or spear phishing or whaling, any of the versions of that, definitely part of social engineering. Phone elicitation tactics, definitely part, and in person, right? But all of them still do involve pretext to the sense. And when I'm emailing, I'm not saying, this is Chris Hadnagy, a professional social engineer, please give me your password. And on the phones, things.
But see, that makes me want to give you my password. No.
To remember that, then.
Well, so do you, do you focus mostly on the social aspect, or do you also, if you're doing, I'm assuming that people pay you to do social engineering pen tests, right?
For the love, that's my favorite thing to do.
So will you set up a phishing site or a spear phishing site? Will you do the baiting with like a USB drop, or will you just do simple physical security stuff like tailgating or piggybacking, seeing if you can get in? I mean, what do you mostly focus on, the social component?
Yeah, say yes to everything you just asked. All of those things are things that I will do if asked, you know, by a company.
Taylor,
how do you handle the fear of getting caught?
That's a really good question. I think I was definitely more nervous in the beginning, maybe. But this is just something I always messed with when I was a kid. I don't know the. That's a route. No one's ever asked me that.
Because I have this psychological fear of failing. So when I go, mind hacking and I try and social engineer a situation, like as a designer, I need to get a design off the ground, or I want a group of people. I want security to give me something that I haven't normally got. You know, like to. I'm in a corporate environment and I want the security person to give me approval for a design, which probably isn't what they want to say yes to. Or if I've got a project manager and I want to get something past them because it suits me, because I want to go home early on a given day instead of staying up all night. The problem is that if they're failing, to me, hurts. And I have the fear of failure when I try and, you know, engineer or socially engineer someone's perspective. But when I actually try and do the social engineering stuff, you know, like hack something by phone or, you know, do a pen test, a social engineering pen test, which I've done a few times, that capability, you know, walking out of a building, someone's computer is kind of, even though I've got a letter saying I'm allowed, it's a thrill and a fear at the same time. How do you cope with that?
I don't get afraid. I was trying to think of an answer where you were saying your thing, and I guess that's something I really need to ponder, because I think preparation, and I'm not saying this about you, I'm just myself, preparation definitely reduces fear, and I also look at what I'm doing as I'm helping. My goal in my SE life, and literally this is whether it's fishing, whether it's physical, or whether it's phone, is everything's about education. That is, that's the motto on our website, security through education. And when I approach a client, my goal is always, what am I going to do to help this person become more secure? What am I going to do to help this company become more secure? So I think my goal set makes my motivation different. So my motivation isn't, I want to hack this company so I can show them how stupid they are. And therefore, if I fail, I'm the stupid one. It's how can I help the company be more secure? So if I fail, then I could say, wow, you guys really are secure. You're great. And here's some things that you can maybe do to be better and continue on that path. And good job.
So Taylor, do you have that feeling, that experience of fear? I mean, how do you deal with that?
Yes, I do. Although I would say, and I think to Chris's point, to some degree, it's all in how you define failure. So I've never been called out during a pen test. And so for me, I think a lot of it really lies in believing your own story enough. If you believe what you're saying enough when you go in, then failure is probably more likely to be having an avenue shut down, right? Having something get, you know, turned down, or maybe something wasn't successful, a particular attack didn't work. But it's very unlikely that I'm going to have somebody say, hey, I know you're trying to social engineer me. You know, what are you, a con man? So instead, you know, somebody may simply not give you their password, or you may not get into that server room that you're trying to gain entry to. But I don't think of that as failure, because there are so many other avenues. There are so many other ways to get that information. So I think a lot of it is really just having the confidence to stand by your story, to really go at it completely and fully. And I think if you do so, then again, the worst case scenario is the failures are they're individual speed bumps. They're hurdles, not failures.
Yeah, I sort of feel I always use this comment with people. I say when somebody gets upset about they call somebody a liar, I say, you know, it's not a lie if you believe it. And I think that's the trick, is you almost have to, it is acting in a way, method acting, you have to believe it yourself, because actually Dan Goleman talks about when you're trying to create empathy, if it's pseudo-empathy with the person on the other side, they will find out. At some point, they detect insincerity. So I think the most successful social engineers would have to believe it. There has to be a component of commitment and belief in order to communicate that to the person on the other side.
And conviction, you know, you just got to stand by it. Social engineering, I don't know what you're talking about, man. I'm just with the help desk, dude. I'm just here to help you, you know. I'll wander off. Good luck. Hope you don't continue to have problems.
That's a really good point that Taylor just made. I had a phone engagement for a company just a couple weeks ago, and it was a multi-staged attack. This was a really beautiful SE engagement because it was total gloves off. We can do whatever we want. So we had sent that offered a free electronic device for people who signed up for the. We had a corporate site that mirrored, and we had I think it was 1,000 people or four, yeah, maybe it was 1,400, something like that, that went and put in their usernames and passwords. It was basically a log into the corporate portal, and we'll automatically enroll you. Then the second tier, which is where this comes in from what Taylor said, is we took those names of people that entered their usernames and passwords, and we called them, and I basically told them, I'm from the IT team, and that website you just went to, that was a phishing site that we set up to test you, and you failed that test. So now what we want to do is help you clean the virus that we installed on your computer. So please download this EXE and run it. And basically, EXE was a reverse interpreter shell. Run it, and then we'll help you clean that off your computer. And
love it.
It's like a double whammy, dude.
Kick a man when he's down.
I know.
Stop him from getting back up again.
Wow.
To get back to Taylor's point, because it was good. But the third stage, which was even more evil, is when we ran the interpreter reverse shell, their antivirus caught it. So we tell them, it looks like the virus you got from that website was much more malicious than we thought. Click yes on that, which allowed us to get the shell. And then I will have security or my IT team log in and fix it. So just hold tight. Then I would. So we got the reverse shell. We then called the IT team, and I made believe I was the person that I was just that we just hacked. So hey, this is Joe. I just clicked on this link and I got this file on my computer, and it says that I got a virus. I can't fix it. Can you log into my machine remotely and fix it? And the IT team had the ability to log in. But now, because we got a reverse interpreter shell and we were key logging, when the IT team logged in to fix the got the VPN credentials for the tech team. So, yeah, that's pretty evil. But anyhow, I want to go back to
okay, let's take a second. We all need to bow down before Chris. That's probably one of the best stories I've heard in a long time. That's you are hereby the Leonardo of social engineering.
Well, thank you, but
that's not necessarily a good thing.
But the point that's to Taylor, which I liked, because we had one woman that we called, and it's always the women who give us the hard time. They seem to be more cautious, and it said, "I don't know if you're really from the tech team." And I said, "You know, you're right about that, but I'm trying to help you." And we stuck to our story, and I recorded this phone call because it was just such a wonderful example, and we used it to say, "Look, here's how some of your people, how good they are." This woman wouldn't give us anything. She would not give us one thing, because she basically said, "Listen, I fell for that stupid phishing scam, and now I'm not going to fall for anything else. So I'm not sure if you are who you say you are. If you want to come to my office and present yourself in front of me, since we're supposed to be in the same building, then I will believe you. But if not, then I'm not believing you." And
I love her.
And now here was the point. Blown our cover. If at any point we said, "You know, you're right, we're part of a security team and blah, blah, blah," she would have ran around the whole office telling everybody that was the case. But we did exactly what Taylor said, which is you got to have the confidence to stick with the story even when you fail. So we stuck with it. "You know, ma'am, you're right. I'm sorry. Thank you for being so secure conscious. What I'll do is I'll have the IT director come down before the end of the day and explain to you why we needed to do this." And then she felt good hanging up with me, so she didn't have to go raise alerts anywhere. And we blow our cover by ruining our story and getting nervous. And that's probably the most important thing. When you get caught, just not getting so nervous that you think you're going to, you know, get tased or something and then start spilling. Just keep to the story. You know, I always carry get out of jail free letter with me too, which is always fun. You get caught and you know, the security guys say, "What are you doing here in the building?" "Oh, well, here's a letter from your boss to do this." And at the bottom of the letter, I always put something like, you know, "P.S. take him to the first conference room that you have and call this extension and notify that you caught him, and we'll put your name on the list, but keep it quiet." So they take me to a conference room and leave me alone to go call, and there's usually a network jack in there, and I'm plugging like a pawn plug into the conference room network jack. And the guy comes back and he's like, "Hey, there was no one at this extension. What, you know, what is that all about?" And I'm like, "I don't know. It's a letter they gave me." I'm like, "You know, write your name down here. I'll make sure they get it on that list." And I write his name down, shake his hand, thank him, tell him to keep this quiet. Now I'm in the building. And he let me in.
Here, I've got a gold star in my bag right here just for you. So it's great.
Wow.
It's just, Taylor said, it's sticking to the story. It's sticking to the story even when you're gonna fail.
So what, you know, I always say that a lot of times a sharp, paranoid person, like a receptionist, we have a great receptionist where I work. She knows everybody, and she's not going to let anybody get by. And I think that's some of the best intrusion detection systems to have somebody like that. So what do you recommend as countermeasures for this type of, for pretexting, for social engineering? What do you tell people after you do a pen test? What do you guys find to recommend?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, because that's probably the one thing that gets overlooked a lot. But I think probably one of the things that we
don't you love the way he keeps saying, "Oh, that's an excellent question. Oh, I've never heard that before." Are you wondering whether he actually means it or whether he's just saying to give you a positive stroke?
Yeah, he's working us.
We already know not to believe anything he says.
And we're taking notes at the same time.
The first thing I think of when somebody says, "That's an excellent point," I'm going, "You're manipulating me. Why the hell would you tell me it's a good question? If I said it, it's a good question, all right?"
See, Greg's taking intensive notes here. He wants to be your star student in your next class.
I use it in corporate environments. I use social engineering to get what I want.
I think
it works brilliantly in corporate environments because they trust you.
So what do we do? How should we train our staffs?
One of the things that we don't do enough is teach critical thinking skills to people. As a matter of fact, I was just reading this article, it was maybe a month ago, about a school district in Texas. Not a school district, it was a county. So this was actually from the government that wanted to outlaw teaching critical thinking skills in school. If you can even believe that, you can Google it and find it.
No.
It would be rage because they said it was too hard and it didn't help children through college. And here was the whole thing. It was a big debate between this big religious and evolutionary groups that were saying critical thinking made kids doubt and question everything. So they were arguing that critical thinking skills were bad for children, and that this type of philosophy is what's happened in the corporate environment. So we tell people, listen to what we say. You know, the boss is the sovereign lord, and that's all there is to it. And we're not really we're taught based on fear. So if you screw up too bad, we're going to can you, and you're going to lose the job that you need in order to feed your family and keep paying your bills. So people don't think about the consequences. There's no critical thinking structure. So I tell people in corporations that I work with is to have scripts. Now, when I say this, before you go blah, let me explain to you what I mean by script. It's not a piece of paper that has an outline of everything a person should say, but it's like the three steps that you should take if you suspect a person is trying to elicit information from you on the phone. And then there should be a step up for each type of attack. So you get an email that you think is a phishing email. What do you do with it? You know, there should be a script. Okay, so first of all, don't click it. Second, hover over the link, see if it goes somewhere that it shouldn't. Three, if you're still in doubt, there should be a team of people that you can send this email to that will check it out in a sandbox and let you know if the email's safe or not. Like an abuse team or an IT team or a security team that can go and check this email out. Too many corporations don't have that. Now, let's take that a step further. What if you got the phishing email and you clicked it and it did go somewhere bad? Now, what's your script of what you should do? There's no critical thinking skills taught to them. So what they do is they delete it and they pray to God it didn't do anything terrible. And then we have a deal like what happened in Coca-Cola, if you read that story, that they were breached for at least 6 months or more before they reported it. And I guarantee
most companies are. Most companies, I think the average is 8 months.
Yep.
Yeah.
I guarantee you something just like that. Some guy got that email. He clicked the link. He was too nervous to report it because, man, I don't want to get canned. You know, I'm the one who did this. And he just says nothing. And that, you know, and they just brush it under the rug.
Well, Ron, why don't you tell – I love how you respond when people call your desk phone.
Well,
you have to tell the story.
It's funny when he says this because I'm the perfect guy. I just say – I say my name when I answer. They usually ask for someone else, and I tell them I can't tell them anything. I you know, they ask if they've reached where we work, and I tell them can't tell them. And I end up actually ending up having to hang up on most people, and they get really angry. But I do it every day because I the person who left the role I'm in must have given his phone number to everyone on the planet because I get calls all the time, and they're always trying to sell me something. And I'm just they ask, can you get me in touch with this person, that person? I just tell them, sorry, bye.
My favorite response to that is, I'm terribly sorry, but you'll have to negotiate with our purchasing division. Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm not permitted to talk to vendors without a purchasing officer present. So if you'd like to talk to purchasing, they'll be able to set up a meeting for you. And then just hang up.
Well, I love to torture census workers because I don't trust anybody. And when people ask, I don't put any of my information. I always put the wrong birth date on things. I'm so paranoid. And census workers call and they say, we just need to know if you work at this place. And I start quoting the Constitution. No, that does not entitle you to this information. I'm so paranoid now because, you know, I hear all these stories from people and I know it can happen. I just, you know, I get offended when people call me and want information from me. And it can be the most seemingly innocuous information. But then my problem is I meet somebody like Ron who tells me what he does with all the information that he can get from social media and how quickly he can munch it. And then I get even more paranoid.
Yeah, well, a little bit of paranoia is probably not a bad thing.
I mean, is social media – do you think – Chris, Taylor, do you think that social media is like the ultimate social engineering?
Oh, media.
I'd say absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Social. One of the other problems though too is I think a lot of companies, they do things that I guess train people in the opposite. I mean, I've received calls from my own credit card company's security department where they'll call me to tell me about something suspicious that they've seen, and I've ultimately determined that it was legitimately my credit card company. But while on the call, they haven't called me, they'll ask me for my social security number or my credit card number. And I'm like, are you serious? I mean, you know, I've picked up a phone – I picked up this call from some random 800 number that's not in my address book, and, you know, So ultimately, it's amazing the number of companies that create these bad habits in the average consumer or the average person – who doesn't have these critical thinking skills.
I know. Right? PayPal has called me before, and I said and my first response was, how do I know you're from PayPal? Prove it.
Exactly.
And I make them tell me more information because I'm like, what? You're just some random 1-800 number. How do I know you're from PayPal? What, I'm going to tell you what I, you know, what I spent money on? No, I don't think so.
Yeah, and I kind of find it – I'm a little bit disappointed that companies like PayPal or Amex or, you know, a big bank wouldn't have a policy where, hey, if I'm in the security department and I'm going to call a consumer, I would call them and say, hello, Mr. Hadnicky. This is Taylor Banks with PayPal. We've detected some suspicious activity on your account. My extension number is 54321. I'd like you to give me a call back at the PayPal, you know, main number, which you can find on the PayPal website, and, you know, please have the call transferred to me so that we can discuss this activity on your account. Something that's going to at least create a habit where somebody, you know, knows to vet the information that they're being asked for.
Okay, we're all going to go out now and pretend to be Amex.
Thanks.
So besides you, of course, Chris, who are the good big SE rock stars?
Hmm. Well, that's a good question. I mean, you know, Kevin still has got his skills.
Yeah, he's got the guy's got some serious props. He's good.
You know, I mean, I always joke with him. You know, when we're together, I tell him, "You're telling the same old story, man." But the guy still has it. You know, he still could get people to tell him information just out of just asking it. He really has a talent that I'm not even sure if he knows what he does because he just does it. It's just like part of him. Chris Nickerson is also really, really good. Nickerson has got a talent for this stuff too. And you know, there's a lot of people out there that are really good at this type of work that just are unknown. You know, they're just people that aren't maybe big in the market. They're not, you know, they're not like Dave Kennedy. Mm-hmm. Wrote Set. He's actually really good at social engineering too. You know, he's actually really, really good at it. I work with a lady who works with me on marketing and stuff, but she's got a psych degree and she's really good at it. You know, there's lots of people who are actually have mastered these skills and been able to really be good at a portion of this or even at just being a whole social engineer, but they just they're not out in the market. You know,
I'll throw another name in the hat there. A mutual friend and acquaintance of mine and Chris is another Chris by the name of Chris Silvers, who does some excellent work and has done a couple of really good presentations on social engineering recently. I'd encourage you guys to check those out as well.
Great. I'll put that in the show notes. So
and that daughter is it up and coming too?
Absolutely, yeah.
Hannah, it's all in the family.
she's a rock star, no doubt about it.
So what do you guys, if I wanted to go out and be a social engineer, if I wanted to take my security career in that direction, I mean, I know, Chris, you've done some great stuff in on your podcast. I know you have some really great people on. For example, you've had Ekman on who, if people don't know this, Ekman is sort of the basis of that show Lie to Me that was on. He has the concept of facial expression awareness, compassion emotions, which is the face technique, and also micro expression training. So, and I know you've done some of that. Is that correct?
Oh, I'm a huge fan of Ekman. I started working with Dr. Ekman probably about 3 years ago. I took a course of his and fell in love as a security guy with the concept of being able to look at someone and understand not why, but understand what they may be feeling. And I felt like this is the wrong way to feel. So I'm using myself as a bad example. For a while, I felt like a superhuman. You know, being able to look at people across a room or a table and just say, man, that guy's feeling some anxiety, he's feeling some anger, he's feeling some sadness. It just really felt like I was empowered. That took me at a whole nother level. I mean, I read all of Ekman's books. I actually got in contact with him. I started to use his courseware in my training, of course, with approval as him. So my 5-day course, we actually cover nonverbals for a whole day and a half. It's like out of 5 days, we talk about that so much. And I've worked with Paul over the last year and a half on different writing. I've given him things that I write, and he'll proof them for me or tell me where I'm wrong and help me work on.
I'm so jealous. He is the coolest.
Well, but in a, because you're jealous, and I like that. Sorry, but I have a chance to go to his house.
Oh,
yeah, and sit with him and have a meal with him and just talk about this science that we can take and move into the security field, you know, move into something that's never been done before, you know. And as security experts, we don't really focus on the nonverbals as much as I feel we can. We even have people say it's not that important, but
Ekman talks about. They've done studies that based on Darwin's early work on emotions, and that they've discovered that I've read that they've discovered that emotional expressions are consistent culturally, that you're going to have this, that disgust is going to look the same on somebody from China as it does on somebody from the West.
It was actually the basis of Paul's one of Paul's books about emotions. Is he went to Papua New Guinea, and he was able to make a deal with a tribe there that has never seen television, a newspaper, or heard a radio outside their tribe. And he spent a couple months there videotaping people under certain different scenarios. And after coming back and analyzing the footage, he was able to determine that there was no difference in the muscular movements of people feeling happiness, anger, surprise, fear, sadness, and contempt, and disgust over someone here in the States or someone in Germany.
Okay. Yeah, that's amazing.
It was just a total same exact muscular movements, indicating that these micro expressions, the movements of our face, are controlled by our neurons, by our brain, and they're not controllable.
Well, what was it? I think I read in one of Ekman's books, my favorite thing that he talks about is deceiver's delight. That when somebody is trying to trick us, they can't help themselves. There's a micro expression where they give it away. and he says, you'll see it. And now I try to look for it a lot. You know, I've read some of Ekman's books. I took one of his online courses. I just think I think his work is really incredible. And if you have teenagers, I think you should be taking his courses and reading his books.
I've worked in Papua New Guinea, and it's a fascinating country. If you ever get a chance to go, don't. I mean, do.
Of course you have.
Never to go there, but
it's an amazing place because it's truly sort of like one of the places in the world where civilization hasn't reached. And I find it fascinating because when I was there, I was able to talk with people. I was actually attempting to teach some locals about computer assembly back in the mid-90s. And I would fly up to train people on how to build computers and maintain PCs and stuff in the day. And there was a terrible culture clash between Papua New Guinean culture and Western culture, where some things were done just because of spiritual or magical basis. But we could always communicate at some level. You know, that one of my favorite stories about Papua New Guinea, if I can indulge, perhaps, maybe not, but anyway, is that they genuinely believed there was smoke inside the computer, because when the power supply blew, the smoke would come out, and therefore there was smoke inside the computer.
When you look at different cultures and studying them,
yeah, I had a similar problem in Fiji, but that's a story for another day.
Well, I'd like to talk a little bit about the legal aspects. I don't think we've covered that enough. Chris, what are your feelings on that?
I think that's probably the not the one thing, but that's one of the things that separates us from being malicious or not. There's a lot of these things that are really illegal if you do them without consent. You know, like for example, dumpster diving. If the dumpster's on the property of the company, if I don't have a contract to do it, I'm trespassing and actually stealing. So having that in the contract is recording phone calls in many states require party consent or at least notification that I'm going to be recording those calls. But in a pen test, if I have that written, I'm relatively safe. Another great one, making believe I'm any form of law enforcement is highly illegal. But if I'm in a pen test and I have that written in the contract, then I'm safeguarded from those things. So having my contracts in order saves me from having to worry about the legalities of a lot of things. But it also does one more thing, and that's if I get caught, I have the contract to state, look, I was hired to do this. You know, you can stop tasing me and waterboarding me. That would be nice.
I mean, have you gotten caught in a situation before? I mean, have you been in an uncomfortable situation where you didn't have all your ducks in a row and you thought that you might get arrested?
This is going to sound horribly arrogant, but no, I've never been caught. But I'll tell you, I've had similar things like what Taylor said, which is where I failed from a point that I did not succeed with the goal, but I stuck to my story so much that I was able to just get out of it. But there was one company I just worked for, and I really disagreed with this policy, but the company – so we did it. What they wanted is after we were successful and I'm going to say breaking into – we had to break into these warehouses, but it wasn't lock picks and things like that. It was we had to get someone to allow us through the front door using a pretext and speech only. And then we had to break every rule. You know, the big signs that say no cell phones, we had to allow them to have our cell phones in our hand. And we had to do all this other stuff that we weren't supposed to be able to do. After we were done doing everything, before we left the building, we were supposed to give a letter to the person that basically let us in stating, by the way, I'm not who I say I am, and this was a security test that you in essence failed. A horrible idea. Because, you know, that person's now thinking their job's in danger. They're thinking that you know, that things are going to be really bad for them, and they hate you. So I did my job. You know, a bunch of warehouses went great, 100% success. Nobody really minded, but I hit one, and I give it to the guy, and he gets physically angry. You know, what do you mean? What do you mean you're not who you say you are? You mean I just let you through my warehouse? What is this? And he goes in and he gets the plant manager. The plant manager comes over, and he reads a letter, and he goes, how do I know you didn't fake this letter? That's actually a really good question. And I said, you don't. And he goes, you're not leaving this building until I verify that you are who you say you are. Now, it happens to be 6:15 at night. You know, I came at the close of business because there was a shift change, and I thought that would be a great time to try. So it's 6:15 at night, and he's going to now try to call people in his corporate office to see if this is legit. He says, come with me. I want you to come with me to this office. I'm going to be safe with it. So, okay, I come to this office. He closes the door and locks it behind me. You know, so I'm now locked in this office and you know, trying to figure out what I'm going to do. I get on my cell phone, call the guy who hired us, and like, you need to verify this. It took this guy about a half an hour, but he finally found someone that was working. And
was this before or after the strip search? Wow.
Yeah, and you know, it wasn't anything bad. It wasn't terrible, but it was, you know, something that, let's say he couldn't find somebody to verify, he very well may have called the police because, you know, I had basically broken and entered. So, you know, interesting scenarios that could occur, and the letters and the contracts and these things, and having a good contact that works the hours you're going to work. These things are important to separate us from the bad guys.
Well, this is it's going to be interesting sometime. Greg and Ethan and I need to get you over a couple of beers to tell us war stories like this, because I bet you just have a million of these. Am I right?
Yeah, I have a few. More, yeah.
Wow. Well, I think we've probably covered this pretty well. I hope that everybody knows that they can get your book, they can listen to your great podcast, and you have some really cool people on the show. I really enjoy listening to it. I get a lot out of it. Also, your class, your website is great. It's got a lot of information on it, and we'll certainly put all of that in the show notes along with the other people you've mentioned, Ekman's books, which I think are very powerful. You know, one of my favorites, How to Break a Terrorist by Matthew Alexander, he talks a lot about very similar things and the way he got information from people in Iraq.
It's a powerful lesson, that book and what he says, because you think of in a war situation when you're with the quote-unquote enemy, you know, being nice to them, how would that work? But it's amazing how well it works when people think they're your friend. And they'll tell you so many things. And it really is a more powerful motivator to give up information, threat of fear or being hurt.
And I really want to thank Taylor, of course. He had to drop off early, but Taylor is always great. He has a lot of experience with pen testing, social engineering. He's a great breaker to have on the conversation. Of course, Ethan, Ron, who has some great experience with linguistics and a great language expert. He always teaches me a lot about language. So thanks for listening. But before you exit the Matrix, I suggest you check to make sure you still have your wallet, your car keys, your social security number, and your integrity. I hope you can follow us on Twitter at Packet Pushers or hang out with our listeners on IRC at Freenode. Visit packetpushers.net to read blogs by the growing Packet Pushers neural network, subscribe to our RSS feeds, plug into our new user forum, and donate to the show because I'm starting to run out of material and I might need to hire a ghostwriter. Email your comments or questions about this show to packetpushers@gmail.com or healthyparanoia@packetpushers.net. And remember, it's healthy paranoia because sometimes they really are out to get you.